You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome to Heritage Voices, episode 32. I'm Jessica Uquinto, and I'll be your host today. And today we're talking about anthropology of the U.S.-Mexico border. Before we begin, I'd like to honor and acknowledge that the lands I'm recording on today are part of the Nootch or Ute Treaty lands, the Dene Tah, and the ancestral Puebloan homeland. Okay, so on today's episode, we have Jason De Leon. Dr. Jason De Leon is a professor of anthropology and Chicano studies at the University of California, Los Angeles, with a lab in the Kotzen Institute of Archaeology. He is the executive director of the 501c3 Undocumented Migration Project Incorporated. He is the author of the award-winning book, The Land of Open Graves, Living and Dying on the Migrant Trail. He's also the president of the board of directors for the Colibri Center for Human Rights and on the academic board for the Institute of Field Research. Prior to joining the faculty at UCLA, Jason taught at the University of Michigan and the University of Washington. He received his PhD in anthropology from Penn State University in 2008 and earned a bachelor's degree in anthropology at UCLA in 2001. In addition to his scholarly pursuits, Jason is an active musician. So welcome to the show, Jason.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I'm very excited to have you. So I actually went to one of your talks years ago. I can't remember if it was at the University of Arizona or Northern Arizona University.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yes. Well, my husband also, he also remembers going to one of your talks, and we couldn't remember if it was because we both went when we were at NAU or if he went up at, he went to school at Western Michigan. So we were trying to figure that out the other
night. I've given talks in both those places.
Yeah. So anyway, ever since then, I remember at the moment just really being like, yes, this is what anthropology should be. So ever since I started this podcast, I was definitely wanting to reach out to you and have you come on the show. And then you won your MacArthur grant. And I was like, oh, shoot, now he's going to be too busy to come on a little podcast. So I'm really excited to have you. And to get us started, do you want to start by talking about what got you into this field?
Sure. Well, number one, thank you for having me. I mean, I'm always appreciative of anyone that wants to learn about the work or listen to me ramble on for God knows how long. But I'm always happy to chat with folks about anthropology and about the research and, you know, just to find as many different ways as I can to, you know, to put information out in the public about things that I think are interesting and important. You know, in terms of how I got into this field, I definitely am of the Indiana Jones, you know, generation, where I'd become really fascinated with archaeology, kind of initially probably through those films, but also through a very early visit to the ancient archaeological site of Teotihuacan in central Mexico. And so I went to Mexico City to see that site when I was probably about 7 or 8. And I remember at the time just really being awestruck by the pyramids and the kind of monumentality of that site. And not really sure what it was, but knowing that I wanted to kind of be a part of that. I wanted to understand history, and I wanted to understand, you know, who had come before me and who were the people that had been responsible for this kind of amazing architectural sort of feat. And I was just always kind of interested in archaeology in junior high school. I went into high school and I was a pretty terrible high school student, or at least off and on. You know, I just always distracted or wasn't that interested in some of the topics. But I ended up taking an art history course with a guy named Rick Vandruff, who immediately recognized that I was interested in certain things like archaeology. And he really was the person who cultivated my interest and just started helping me to focus on ancient art history and the connections to archaeology. And he was probably the first person that told me that I could make a career out of archaeology. And so he kind of set me on that path. And I went to college, was really ready to get started to study anthropology, to study archaeology, you know, to kind of be Indiana Jones. And then realized that, number one, I had been lied to about what archaeology was actually like. And two, it was presented to me, more importantly, much of the archaeology that I was exposed to early on was incredibly boring. Even I would say, just in general, my introduction to anthropology was either really boring or really problematic. And, you know, I come from an era of students where people were still showing the kind of grainy footage of naked you know, brown skin, dark skin people from far off places, and pitching that as like, this is what anthropology is. And so I was really turned off by that initially, just because I felt like, well, this isn't what I really signed up for. And I'm not connecting with this. And I find it to really problematic. And then I kept taking classes though, cause I didn't know what else to do. I didn't have any other kind of job skills. And I wasn't even sure what job skills I had to help me become an anthropologist, other than the fact that I was really good at hanging out with people. I had traveled quite a bit because I was an army brat. So I'd been around the world a lot and always had been the kind of odd person out. So I had a skill set related to trying to connect with people from different backgrounds. But it wasn't until I took a class called The Anthropology of LA, where I was asked to go out into the world and do ethnography in my own kind of communities, where that really got me excited about the discipline and seeing the potential for the work. But I continued to study archaeology and, you know, eventually ended up pursuing archaeological work in Mexico and then going on later to do a dissertation in ancient Mesoamerica, which by the time I finished that, I had then decided to jump ship and to go back to thinking about contemporary cultural issues.
Yeah. So what was it exactly that made you, so you finish a PhD, which first of all, I mean, that's a big commitment. And then to come out of it and realize that you don't like what you're doing. What was that process like?
You know, I felt like I was spending a lot of time asking questions that were so esoteric and that, you know, that a handful of people in the world were really concerned about. And it just felt like my time was better served doing other stuff. And along the way, as I was doing the archaeological work, you know, I got to know a lot of local work people, women and men who were ditch diggers on these excavations in Mexico, working class folks who had immigration experience in the Arizona desert or in the United States, or people who were getting ready to migrate. And I just got much more interested kind of in their perspectives than the stuff was coming out of the ground. And I think part of what happened too is that, you know, I had been trained in this very traditional way, which I hopefully we're not doing much of this anymore. I think we still are in some places, but it was a type of archaeology that didn't really consider the kind of local community perspective. You know, the local community was a community that you were using to get your data. Occasionally, maybe you'll give a talk, but that was kind of the extent of the commitment to these communities. I think if I had been exposed to these more kind of like indigenous approaches to archaeology, community-based archaeological research, that sort of stuff, I probably would have stuck with it. But I had become so disillusioned with the way in which I had been trained and the disconnect from kind of living people that I decided to jump ship completely. You know, I love archaeology. I feel like I come back to it in different kinds of ways. And I'm thankful for that training. But I had really hit a point where it just felt like I was spending all this time looking at stone tools, and there was a lot of stuff going on in the world that felt more important at the time and still does. I mean, I do think studying stone tools is important. I think archaeology is a crucial field of research. I just prefer the types of archaeology now that's more interactive, that's more sensitive to community issues, especially, you know, things like indigenous issues. You know, I came very much from an old school kind of background that sort of soured me on that approach. And for sure now, you know, I have no, I have no patience for that type of archaeology anymore. I mean, the first thing I ask with that type of work is, okay, well, what does the community say? How are you involved with folks? You know, how are you giving back? How are you empowering these communities to take ownership of their archaeological heritage? But that was for sure, that was such a far, far away thing from what I had been trained to kind of be thinking about archaeological research.
Yeah. So, okay. Thinking about that, I'm really curious about what those conversations were like with the people that you were working with from the local community when you were doing those excavations. I mean, did they find the excavations relevant at all to their lives? Or was it like you're saying that this was kind of unimportant compared to what they felt like was happening with migrations and things like that?
You know, in Mexico, I think the relationship that folks have to the archaeological heritage, it's kind of context dependent. You know, when I worked in more kind of indigenous communities, the archaeology was of great importance for all kinds of reasons. When I was working kind of with more working class, you know, Mexicans, people who have an indigenous ancestry but don't identify as indigenous, you know, the archaeology was just something that was kind of paying the bills, and they were interested in it a little bit, but not to the extent of, you know, they wanted to become archaeologists. They wanted to, you know, take ownership of a local kind of museum. And I think part of it is just because those folks weren't seeing, you know, like indigenous communities in Mexico, especially like in the Maya area, they've been able to capitalize on things like the tourism industry and to be able to both preserve their archaeological heritage while at the same time be able to make a living from it. And many of the places that I worked just did not have that infrastructure for that. So the archaeology was this kind of very foreign thing that paid a wage, but at the end of the day, you know, the community wasn't seeing a whole lot of other kinds of benefits from this work, unfortunately.
Right. And we talked about that some more in episode 26. We talked about archaeology outreach in Maya communities in the Yucatan. So if you're interested in hearing more about indigenous Maya experiences with the archaeology from this podcast, check out episode 26. Moving forward. So you mentioned that you were interested more in these contemporary issues. So how did you get to this particular issue that you're working on?
I was working in Mexico as an archaeologist. I was talking to all kinds of folks who had had immigration experiences, and their stories were really inspiring to me and also really depressing. And I, you know, hearing about people almost dying in the desert and that kind of stuff. And it made me realize that I knew very little about immigration, despite the fact that I thought that I knew quite a bit. I had grown up in South Texas along the U.S.-Mexico border. I grew up with lots of family members who were undocumented. I had spent a lot of time in Mexico, kind of moving back and forth. But I realized that I still did not know much about this issue. And so those guys just really kind of inspired me to then take my research skills, you know, in this case, archaeology, and my growing interest in ethnography, and to see if I could use those skills to do something that felt much more kind of socially relevant. But it was a total shot in the dark. Basically finished my dissertation. I went on the job market and I was applying for jobs. I had 10 years of archaeological experience working in Mexico and other places. I had been publishing stuff on, you know, stone tools and ancient salt production and that kind of stuff. And then I wrote in these cover letters, I'm not doing that anymore. All of a sudden now I'm going to start working on immigration issues. And thankfully things kind of worked out, but it was a long and at times kind of painful process to kind of reinvent myself as some new kind of researcher. And I think if I had done it a year later, you know, the market crashed the year after I went on the job market in 2007. And I think that if that had happened in 2008, I don't know what I would have ended up doing, because I was, you know, I applied for like 75 jobs my first year out. I got 74 rejections and one interview. And the one interview was the job that allowed me a couple of years to reinvent myself and to think about the relationship between ethnography and archaeology within the context of immigration.
As regular listeners will know, I'm actually an ethnographer by training. I work in the cultural resource management field, but I'm not an archaeologist, although my husband and pretty much everybody else around me is archaeologists, or are archaeologists, I should say. Yeah, so I guess there's two places that I want to go next. The first one is, how did you take this interest? Okay, so you knew you wanted to work on undocumented immigration and use archaeology and ethnography to look at this current issue. But I mean, it doesn't seem like there was a lot of guidance on how to do something like that, or how to even approach something like that. So how did you form your methodology? How did you shape that study?
You know, like most things in my life, I just made it up as I went. You know, I've never had a good plan beyond like a 2-week window. And, you know, with this stuff, I had gotten interested in immigration, and I had started to see that migrants were leaving stuff in the Arizona desert, you know, that there was this archaeological record. And so I just went down to Arizona, had someone show me around, show me this stuff. And then I just started thinking, okay, if I think about this as archaeology, what would be the methods that I would want to use? You know, survey, artifact collection, mapping, that kind of stuff. And I just took the skills that I had been using on ancient stone tools and just started applying them to the things that I was seeing on the ground. But, you know, there wasn't a blueprint really for that, other than the Tucson Garbage Project, which even that was only helpful to a certain extent. I mean, this was a just a lot of experimenting and saying, okay, can we do this? What happens if I take traditional archaeological methods and put them into this current and then this contemporary context? Can I say something interesting? And that's what we just started doing, experimenting with different approaches and then saying, okay, I've got this archaeological data. How do I connect it to the ethnographic data? And I've spent the last kind of 10 years, you know, experimenting with different ways of bringing these things together, whether it's the archaeological data or the forensic data or the ethnographic, just finding different ways to pull the stuff together, see if it works together. If it complements one another, that's great. If it contradicts, that's also really interesting. And so trying to accept failure as a moment of growth and to rethink a kind of approach, but just pretty much made it up as I went the whole time. And I mean, I think I'm still doing that with all these other kinds of projects. But it keeps me fresh and keeps me really worried about things, which I think when I'm worried and stressing out about a project or an idea, that's when I feel like I'm doing the best kind of work, when I'm doing the most due diligence, when I'm thinking long and hard about the ramifications of the work, typically is when I'm not sure what I'm doing. And so I like that kind of not having a safety net to know whether or not the stuff is going to succeed or not.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like to a large extent, we're all doing that, right? I mean, you have kind of your methods that you learn in school or that you learn through experience, but you're always figuring out how they piece together with whatever project you're working on. And if you're not continually questioning that, then you're probably not really giving it all it deserves or moving the field forward. That's for sure.
Yeah. I mean, I think for me, it's all about an organic approach. Does it make sense? Does it feel right? Then keep doing it. And then when you fail, take stock and go, okay, why did it fail? What was I doing wrong? What could I have done better? And then how do I move forward?
Okay. Well, on that note, we're already at our first break. We will be back here in a moment. Hey, everyone. It's Jessica from Heritage Voices. And I just wanted to tell you today a little bit about doing some advertising or sponsoring on the Archaeology Podcast Network. And if you are interested in doing a sponsorship or ads on the Archaeology Podcast Network, go to www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/ads. That's www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/ads. And you can do individual shows or you can sponsor the whole network as well. So I hope that if you're a company or you work for a company or you have some sort of product that you're selling, that you will consider doing an ad or a sponsorship on the Archaeology Podcast Network. It helps you get noticed and it helps good work get out there. All right, thanks. And we are back. Okay, so going off of that last conversation that we were just having, I'm really curious if you could paint a little bit of a picture for our listeners of what that all looks like on the ground. So what does the archaeology look like on the ground? What does the ethnography look like on the ground? And then getting into the forensic portion that you mentioned.
Yeah, I mean, I think depending on the day of the week that you catch me, I'm either an ethnographer, an archaeologist, a forensic scientist, a photographer, exhibition curator. Every day is a bit different for us. And the field work, I mean, so like the work in Arizona or the work in Southern Mexico, it could be that I spend a day hiking out in the desert, collecting the objects that migrants have left behind, recording the location of sites where people have been sleeping or camping or changing their clothes. So using a handheld GPS to document sites, maybe photographing and mapping a site, occasionally collecting materials and curating them like we would any typical archaeological assemblage. That could be a day. Another day could be spending time in a migrant shelter with people who've just been deported or who are getting ready to migrate, conducting interviews with them, doing life history interviews, giving them cameras so that they can photograph their own experiences either in Mexico or on the migrant trail. So, you know, a lot of the kind of hanging out that ethnographers do, that's a big part of the work. Or it could be the forensic stuff where for several years we've been trying to understand what happens to the bodies of migrants who die in the Arizona desert. Through different forensic experiments using the bodies of pigs, which are the closest proxy for the human body that we have available because of the similar organ distribution, weight, skin type. We've been documenting how the bodies of pigs decompose in different contexts over the years to get a sense of how quickly do humans decompose, what are the different types of things that impact the body, whether it's scavenging animals or environmental conditions, and how do these conditions then impact our ability to locate remains and to identify people. So depending on, you know, on the project or the types of questions that we're asking, I could be doing a whole range of different things. So some of it, and I think some of it looks very traditionally archaeological. I mean, I've run archaeological field schools in the past. I've run ethnographic field schools in the past that either do those things in isolation or really combine those things.
Yeah. And as far as the part of the pigs decomposing, if you go to Radiolab, it'll be in the show notes. They do a border trilogy and they really get into detail on a lot of how exactly they did that part of the study. So I won't go into that there, but you should definitely listen. It's a really, really fascinating set of three episodes. I just listened to it with my husband on a drive back from New Mexico. And I mean, again, I grew up in Tucson, Arizona. So right, again, also along the US-Mexico border. And I did a lot of, I took anthropology classes at the University of Arizona. A lot of them were specifically focused on Mexico or the US borderlands. And it's amazing how much there still is to learn. That those three episodes, I learned a huge amount. And I thought before that I already knew a lot about the border situation, but it was definitely very interesting and you should all go check that out. It'll be in the show notes. What I do, I mean, again, I'm an ethnographer, so naturally I'm really curious to hear more about that aspect. And then also tying into that, there's about like 40 or 50 just initial ethics considerations that come to my mind. And I'm sure that's an ongoing challenge that you face. So I'd be really curious to hear some of the types of ethical issues that you've faced and how you've addressed them as the study has progressed.
Yeah. I mean, I think if you're not worried about ethics, then you're not doing a very good job as an ethnographer. And, you know, the ethical challenges, I mean, I work with communities that are incredibly vulnerable, highly exploitable. You know, my job is to make sure that I am representing them as they want to be seen. My job, I think, is to constantly be checking in with them about these are the types of things I'm writing about. These are the types of things that I'm interested in understanding. And I need help to do that. You know, the difference, I think, from like my work and the work of journalists who study immigration issues is that I'm fully committed to the people that I work with. And I try to develop, you know, very long-term sorts of relationships. Yeah, I mean, so it's a constant struggle, but it's everything from representation, the use of photography, what to reveal, what not to reveal. I mean, it's an evolving struggle. And I joke that as long as I don't sleep well at night because I'm worrying about these things, that's how I know that I'm really doing a good job. And I would hope, like in my book, you know, people are given a lot of space to tell their own stories. I try to give as much page space to people's exact words. And so rather than paraphrasing or retelling someone else's story, to say, okay, here are dozens of pages of this person telling their experiences directly to the reader. And I think for me, that's a really important thing, is to how do I empower folks to take ownership of these stories that I am the translator for, or I am the kind of the moderator. You know, I control the editing at the end of the day, and I have to be aware of that. But at the same time, trying to figure out then how do I edit or moderate, and at the same time allow people space to be present, to be visible, and to be heard. I've tried to do that in a whole bunch of different ways. And you know, whether that's through the direct excerpts from interviews, whether that's having people take their own pictures of their own experiences, you know, giving feedback on different kinds of elements of the project. But it's constantly checking in with the communities that I work with, so that they know what I'm doing, and that I feel really good that they're supportive of the work.
Right. And one of the first things that came to mind that we'll get to later in this conversation is your exhibit. And I was noticing, for example, that the exhibit is going to be shown in Nogales, Sonora. And, you know, my first response is like, what kind of trauma is this invoking for local people, having, you know, this kind of exhibit that again, we'll talk about here in a little bit, that really points out the inhumanity of what's happening. But on the other hand, you know, without the exhibit, there's also this erasure, you know, like people feeling like their story is not being heard, they're not being represented, they're not being humanized. So it's really tricky. That was one of the first ethics considerations that came to my mind. How do you walk that line between trauma, you know, like possibly re-traumatizing people basically, or I don't even know how to phrase this, but I guess, yeah, I'll let you take it from there.
You know, my sense with this work is that migrants want to be seen. I mean, they mm-hmm. want to be visible, they want to be heard, and they want the public to understand that they suffer greatly, you know? And so, of course, there's always the worry about traumatizing people or re-traumatizing them. But at the same time, you know, I've never had someone tell me they didn't want their story to be told. I've never had someone tell me that they didn't want the public to know just how brutal the experiences are. I mean, and if you look at my first book, I mean, there's pictures in the book of a woman, a 31-year-old woman from Ecuador named Maricela Zaguipuyas, whose body we found in 2012. And we only show her picture because her family was like, you need to show this picture. People need to see what happened to her and understand that this is not a made up story, that people die every day. And of course, it's traumatizing for the family, but at the same time, they want her story to be heard. And I think that's, you know, that's the thing with this exhibition that we're doing, Hostile Terrain 94, which is essentially a collaborative exhibition with over 100 communities around the globe, where we ask people to come together for a few days and to fill out toe tags for 3,000 plus people who have lost their lives while crossing the Arizona-Mexico border since 2000. We asked them to bear witness to this suffering by writing down the names of the dead and the details of what happened to them, and then mounting them on this giant wall in the exact location where those people were found, so that both they can bear witness and so that other people can bear witness. You know, it's not an easy thing to do. It's not something that's done lightly. And obviously it's something that comes with a lot of emotional baggage. But I think for me, And the feedback that we've gotten from folks is that despite the pain that is caused by making this thing and by being a part of the construction of this exhibition, at the end of the day, it's important to recognize that if we don't do this, people will forget. People don't know. You know, I think the migrant communities really want to be empowered to show people, look, this is what we're telling you our lives are like. This is these are the experiences that we're having. And many people in these exhibitions, on these wall of toe tags, don't have names, aren't identified. Their families are still wondering what happened to them. And for me, this exhibition is an attempt to make them visible and to at least temporarily have them be recognized as a human being who lost their lives. And, you know, obviously that's a hard thing to be a part of and to see. And it's emotionally, you know, very, very taxing. But I think we live in a moment where if we don't do this, you know, the counter narrative of that migrants are horrible people, that they're evil, they're coming here to destroy this country, or that they don't even exist, I think that narrative is more dangerous than this one. And so we've got to find any kind of way to counter the demonization of migrants or the erasure of migrants. And unfortunately, a lot of people have died because of immigration policies, and I don't want people to forget that. And I don't think many of the migrants want people to forget. They want people to know what has happened to them. So, I mean, but it's risky. I mean, it is a risky endeavor, but you know, we work in partnership with all these different host communities to make sure that everybody that's involved is being involved in a healthy way, and that this is not, that they're not going to walk away feeling worse about it, but hopefully they'll walk away with you know, maybe feeling empowered or maybe feeling like recognized for just a moment in time.
Yeah, and it's kind of interesting timing. I know this episode won't come out for a little bit, but with everything that's happening right now, you mentioned the power of photography of human remains, and right now that is very much in the news, and also with the conversation around the detention camps.
You know, I think, I mean, right now the photo that's been circulating of this 24-year-old Salvadoran father and his 2-year-old daughter, you know, this horrific image is circulating and people are up in arms and they're, you know, I can't believe this is going on kind of thing. And my response is like, number one, you know, we shouldn't be circulating the images of the image of this person's body. I mean, there's, mm-hmm. this is traumatizing mm-hmm. for the family. Nobody's given permission for this image to show. I know people want to raise awareness about this issue. I don't necessarily think that photo is the way to do it. And, you know, even just this week, I've been trying to counter that and saying, look, there aren't enough photographs in the world to convey the pain and suffering that current immigration border policies have inflicted upon people. But if you need an image to circulate to help you understand the scale of this issue, you know, use this one. And I've been circulating an image of Southern Arizona that shows 3,100 red dots representing, you know, thousands of people who have died in the region since 2000. I think that the go-to, it could be really easy to just say, here's a picture of a dead body. Let me show it to you, shock you, and maybe that'll raise awareness about stuff. But I don't think that that's really effective. And obviously, we circulate the images of the dead in all kinds of ways for all kinds of reasons. But then people kind of lose interest, or they become desensitized to this issue. And I think it's kind of my job as an anthropologist to provide more nuance to these types of issues. And it's not just about shock and awe, but it's about educating, and it's about having something stick with people. Because I'm sure that many of the people who see this image of this poor person and his daughter, they're not going to remember this in a month. Mm-hmm. You know, it'll be replaced by some image of a dead child from Syria or from, you know, the Mediterranean. We cycle through those images so quickly, and we've got to find smarter and more sensitive ways to enlighten the public. But that's, you know, that's another issue. You know, and I work quite a bit with photography, and it's always trying to figure out, you know, what is the right image to use, and when do you pull back. And thankfully, you know, I'm not a journalist. I don't have to get the shot. I can put the camera down for as long as I want. I don't have to rely on one image to tell a story. You know, the images are part of this much larger data set, whether it's the ethnography, the archaeology, or the forensic science. And so it allows, I think, for more nuance in storytelling and more sensitivity. But unfortunately, you know, with migrants, you know, it's easy. Everybody's looking for that shot of the dead or the sad migrant, unfortunately, because we consume it as readers of newspapers and as people who consume, you know, the daily news cycle. But a lot of times I think those things are just doing more harm than good. Although we currently live in a moment where the brutalization that migrants are experiencing, I think it has to be seen in some sense, at least in terms of the kids in detention centers and that kind of stuff, because it's been going on for far too long and nobody's been paying attention to it.
Well, and I think that even, you know, for example, again, I grew up in Tucson. It was not, there was always the annual body count of the desert, you know, like that was always news, but definitely it wasn't until later in life that I realized how much deeper all of it goes, that, you know, it's not just literally crossing the desert, that people are hugely vulnerable for long periods before they even get to the border. I remember in college, there was an obscene statistic about the number of sexual assaults that migrants face in their journey north. And it was just one of those statistics that was just truly shocking. The number of women especially, but also men who face sexual assaults at some point during their migration. It's, you know, right up there with the number of indigenous women that face the same thing. And just to see the brutality and the lack of response or understanding or movement on that is pretty shocking once you kind of get more of a full picture of what's happening. So I guess, and we're about to hit another break here, but looking at all of that, what is it? Is there something that people can do to help these issues, like the detention camp issue? Is there something that people can do more in their daily lives to help address these situations?
You know, they can support nonprofits like the Colibri Center for Human Rights, which works to reunite family members with the remains of their loved ones. It helps to identify bodies recovered in Arizona that are currently in the morgue. You know, there's great organizations that people can donate to, but also I think just being educated, you know, learning more about this issue, reading up on this stuff, especially the fact that we're coming up on an election cycle. And being able to call out the bullshit that politicians are going to be spewing about immigration. You know, what does immigration reform look like, right? Why are people migrating? What does Latin America look like? Why is Honduras the way that it is? I think just really being aware of those things can help inform people's lives in all kinds of ways, you know, because not everybody's going to be able to go down and protest or volunteer their time. But I think just being educated and being able to share that knowledge with others is a really important step. And then from there, you know, once you kind of have a better sense of the issue and the deep history of it, then maybe you can figure out, okay, where is my time kind of best spent? Is it raising money? Is it volunteering my time? Is it educating? You know, but I think education really is the first kind of starting point, because you can donate money one time and then forget about this issue. And that money might go to help a person once. But I think in general, we as a society just need to be much smarter about this stuff, so that we can identify when we're being lied to, when things are happening that are not right, that are not just, but we have to have the educational background to be able to see that stuff.
Okay. Well, on that note, we are going into our second break. We'll be right back. Jessica again, and just putting in a plug for everyone to volunteer with the Archaeology Podcast Network. We need volunteers to keep doing what we're doing. And more than that, if you're interested in a side hustle, some of these positions could also turn into income generating volunteering. So if you're looking to earn some cash on the side, this could be a good opportunity to do that. And we need help with things like producing, social media, marketing, design, etc. So if you're interested in learning more, looking for a way to earn some cash, maybe during the down season of field season, please go to www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/volunteers. Again, that's www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/volunteers. Okay, so something that you were just talking about there, I kind of want to talk a little bit more about. So you mentioned that people can volunteer their time. And one thing I'm curious about is, you know, there's the situation that I'm not sure a lot of people have heard about, but with, I believe it's No More Deaths in Tucson, correct? That there's
the Scott Warren case.
Yes, exactly. The Scott Warren case, facing charges for volunteering to help migrants cross in the desert. I believe he was bringing water, correct?
Yep.
Okay.
Well, we're in a moment, right, where humanitarian aid is becoming criminalized, right? Where we've got laws that people find unjust, and to try to alleviate the pain associated with these unjust laws, right, people are being prosecuted. There's a war being waged against people who find some of these laws unjust. And we're in an important kind of historical moment where we as a society, have to decide whether or not we're going to follow the law just because it's the law, or whether we're going to argue for the changing of laws because we find them to be unjust. And I think that people are doing a lot of soul searching right now and figuring out, well, how, if I care deeply about this issue, how far am I willing to go to fight for this thing? You know, it's a scary time. We're seeing a lot of horrible things happening to people, and folks who don't think this stuff is just are being put into this position of like, well, what do I do? Do I risk my own life? Do I risk my own kind of well-being because this thing is, I find this thing to be unjust or not? I think many Americans are asking themselves right now, what are they going to do about this? And it's tough. I mean, it really is tough because I do think that there are a lot of laws in place that are so unjust, and yet many people will blindly follow them because they're the law. And you get this argument a lot from like anti-immigrant folks. People will say, well, these people in Arizona, they're dead because they broke the law. The law is the law. It's that simple. And I would argue that nothing is that simple. And I don't care, you know, just because it's a law does not mean that it's right. And we could think about all of the legal discrimination that has been a part of American history since its founding, whether it's who gets to vote, who gets to get married, you know, who has rights and who doesn't. We see that laws over time, you know, they're overturned because they're unjust. And I think we're in a moment right now where we're seeing many of these immigration laws that are happening as being shown for the horrible things that they actually are. And it's just, but people are really being asked to then take a side. And yeah, you got to figure out what side of history do we want to be on? Because we know that these things are not going to stay like this forever. They can't. And I don't want to look back in 20 years and tell my kids, you know, when this stuff was going down, I just said, well, fuck it. Law's a law, you know, right. That's, if you see injustice in the world, I think it's your responsibility as a human being to speak up about it and to figure out how best you can be involved in helping to ensure, as far as I'm concerned, helping to ensure equal rights for everyone.
Well, I guess, first of all, is that how you felt with you and yourself and your students? Have you felt like you've had to put yourself a little bit against, not against the law, but you know what I mean? Like put yourself in a little bit of a gray area or a less safe situation than you would like to be in order to do this kind of work. And second of all, talking about the law versus justice and what's right. I mean, it seems like there's a lot of, for example, let's look at the Border Patrol. I mean, in my lifetime, when I was growing up in Tucson, the Border Patrol was not, it wasn't that noticeable when I was a kid. Now it's very noticeable. And it's basically, it's an industry. So at some point, you know, you can't just take away the Border Patrol or reduce it in force without creating another economic issue. So at some point, the system is just set up in a way that I'm not even sure if there is a way out or a way forward. I'm not sure what that would look like. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I mean, I think we waste a lot of American taxpayer dollars on border security issues that are fabricated. I think that, you know, the Border Patrol is a bloated organization that is very good at justifying expenditures while at the same time not being accountable, being very difficult to evaluate. And we have to keep in mind that a lot of people are heavily invested in the border industrial complex. So building more detention centers, hiring more agents, all that kind of stuff. I mean, people profit from that. And I think it's profits that really drive this whole thing. And the anxieties we have about immigration are just a smokescreen to allow people to profit from this thing. And I think the system is bloated. I mean, we just keep putting more money into it. I mean, this whole thing about we're going to build this wall, right? How much money is that going to cost? And we know that right. it would have literally no effect on anything. Yet right. people are behind it because they see that it's a way to generate profits. I mean, all people thinking about right. the detention centers, it's not just because America hates migrants. It's not just because we're a bunch of hypocrites and because we demonize Latinos. Those are issues. At the same time, many people are making a lot of money off of detention centers, and that's what keeps right. the system running. And people need to understand that it's about economics in so many ways. And the immigration issue becomes a smokescreen to hide that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, if you want to feel a little hopeless, I guess, listen to that Radiolab episode or the series of them, because it just lays out exactly a lot of how kind of silly it all is, or not silly. I mean, because obviously it's not funny, but the Border Patrol efforts and how basically I feel like a lot of what it does is, yeah, like you're saying, justify itself. Going back to your work, have there been any like particular highlights of your efforts through the years? Any moments that were particularly like you felt like successful or creative or effective?
Well, you know, I think the work is fulfilling no matter what, because it allows me to work with amazing students. I think that I've worked with hundreds of students over the years in different ways in the field and in the lab. And I'm proud of those relationships, and I'm proud of the many students that I've been able to mentor and the students that I've learned a great deal from. I'm really proud of the relationships that we have developed with migrants, with people who have shared their stories with us and allowed us to tell their stories to the public. I think for me, that's been really inspiring. You know, obviously there's lots of stories that I've been involved with that don't have happy endings, that have been really depressing. But at the same time, I'm always grateful, at least though, that the folks who have lost their lives in this horrific tragedy, I've been able to facilitate in some small way the telling of their story so that they're not forgotten. And so that if one more person knows the name of Maricela Zaguipuyas or her 15-year-old cousin who went missing in a year after her, Jose Takuri, if one person knows about their story, for me, that's a small victory. You know, it's hard to stay motivated. I think right now in this kind of Trump era, the world is on fire, but in a really visible way. And it's hard to stay kind of positive, but I have to remind myself and remind others that it's always been like this. This was happening under Clinton. This was happening under Obama. Trump is just the kind of most recent person. He's the most vocal about it, and the one who's not doing a very good job of hiding it. Kind of, he's embracing the horribleness. But it's been happening for a really long time. But I try to use this current moment where we're all feeling really just life is hard right now. It's hard to be an American right now, and imagine how hard it must be to be a migrant right now. I try to use this moment though to inspire the work more, to say, okay, well, now more than ever is when you can't give up. Now more than ever is when you have to be motivated to keep doing this work, to keep raising awareness, to keep doing the research, because it's needed. And I would say, if I, maybe one of my more proud moments is, for many years, I had been making the argument that the things that migrants leave behind in the desert is part of American history. It's part of America's shared immigration story. It might be unpopular right now in this current political moment, but the things that are left in the Arizona desert are as equally valuable as the things people have left in places like Ellis Island. It's part of our shared history, and we have to understand that. And people used to laugh at me. I mean, I get laughed at a lot in the beginning. I'm not an archaeologist. I'm someone who goes around and picks up migrant trash in the desert, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And we made that argument for a long time that it's not trash, that it's cultural patrimony. It needs to be respected. It needs to be conserved. It needs to be understood. And I think the moment where I really felt like I'd finally made that point was when the Smithsonian took about 110 objects from our collection for permanent, to add to the permanent collection. And you can go right now to the American History Museum, and you can see numerous objects from the Arizona desert that we've collected that are on permanent display in an exhibition called One Nation, Many Voices. And I think for us, that was a real crucial moment of recognition. And like, look, we keep fighting this fight, and we want this experience of these immigrants to be respected. And that for us was a really was an important moment when this institution, this American institution, recognized the value in these materials.
Okay, so where is there like a place that you'd like to go next with all of this? I mean, I know that it's constantly changing and responsive to what's happening, but is there something that you're excited about of where you want to take all of this next?
Well, you know, my life is consumed right now by this global exhibition we're doing in 2020. So that's for the next kind of probably 16 months. That's all I'm really doing. So we're not doing a lot of field work right now. I'm also trying to finish a book that's about smugglers and photography. So that's kind of the next book project. But I don't know what's going to come after that. I don't have an active field project at the moment. So I'm just kind of excited to see what happens in 2020, how the exhibition goes, get some traction on this book, and then figure out, you know, where in the world do I want to be next, or what's the kind of pressing question that I think I can best address? But I like this openness. I mean, I feel like my life for the next 2 years, 2.5 years is probably set. I've got lots of things to finish up, but then after that, it's kind of open. And so, like everything else, you know, I'm going to just kind of organically see where the day takes me, and hopefully I'll land on both feet.
Yeah, I'm sure. Have you ever, okay, sorry, just side note. Have you ever done any work looking at like the migration situation in Europe versus the US-Mexico border, or intra-continent migration, like to places like Argentina from other places in South America? Just curious personally.
You know, I've spent some time in the Mediterranean, in Lampedusa, and we're doing 10 exhibitions in 2020. We're doing one in Greece. We're doing two in Italy. We're doing three or four in Germany. So we've got all these exhibitions that are about Arizona, but that are in Europe as an attempt to connect it to the Mediterranean issue. And so that's definitely something that we're excited about, is drawing these parallels and helping people to understand that we live We live in a moment now where migration is a global crisis, and it's affecting everybody all over the place. And we need to see the parallels of what's happening along the US-Mexico border, along the Guatemala-Mexico border, along the Venezuela border with Argentina and elsewhere, the Mediterranean. And so, we're really always trying to think more broadly in this work. And potentially a next project could take us to a place like Europe to start thinking about this issue.
Yeah, that'd be fascinating. Okay, so here to close out, could you tell everyone about your first book? Give us some more of a background for people that might want to check it out.
Yeah, my first book is called The Land of Open Graves, and it is about the way in which the Arizona desert has been used by the federal government, by the American federal government, as a way to deter migrants from migrating. Basically, we have tried to funnel them towards places like the Sonora Desert, where they have to walk upwards of 50 miles to get into the United States, as a way to slow them down. And the book revolves around a policy called prevention through deterrence, which relies heavily on nature as a obstacle to movement. And it has knowingly killed thousands of people. it has knowingly put millions of people in harm's way. And so the book really follows the development of this policy and its impacts on people's lives. And so it follows three different sets of stories. There's two men that I met in a migrant shelter in Mexico that I call Memo and Lucho. The first part of the book follows their journey through the desert, told through their eyes. The second part of the book is about this woman, Maricela, from Ecuador, whose body we found in 2012, and about why she was there and the backstory to her life. And then the third part is about her 15-year-old cousin who migrates a year after she does.
And in addition to this book, which there'll be a link in the show notes for that as well, are there any other resources that you recommend for people wanting to learn more?
You know, people can go to our websites, undocumentedmigrationproject.com, to learn about the overall project. They can go to jasonpatrickdeleon.com to learn about projects that like talks and lectures that I'm doing, that kind of stuff, events associated with the project. And they can go to hostileterrain94.com to learn about this global exhibition that we're launching next year. We've got about 7 or 8 prototypes that are happening this year all over the US and in Mexico and potentially Europe. And then in 2020, this exhibition will be in 110 locations in the United States, in Latin America, Canada, Europe, and hopefully actually Australia, and hopefully Asia and Africa as well.
Are you actually going to all of those places?
No, thankfully I won't. I mean, I'll go to a small subset of those.
Yeah. Wow. Okay.
That'd be a lot of frequent flyer miles.
Any last things that you wanted to add that we didn't get to?
No, I think that's it. I mean, I think people should just get educated, and hopefully, you know, if they go to our websites, they can read news stories and they can get more information about this issue.
Okay. Sounds good. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. It was great to talk to you.
Thank you.
Yeah, and especially great to show, you know, again, this is normally we talk about indigenous archaeology in a very different context than this. So this was great to show that there's descendant or associated communities for all different types of archaeology. So really glad that we could have this conversation.
Oh, it's been my pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the Heritage Voices podcast. You can find show notes at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/Heritage Voices. Please subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, or the Google Music Store. Also, if you like the show, please share with your friends or write us a review. If you have any questions, comments, or show suggestions, please reach out to me at jessica@livingheritageanthropology.org, or you can find me on Facebook through Living Heritage Anthropology or on Twitter @LivingHeritageA. As always, thank you to Lyle Blanqua and Jason Nez for their collaboration on our incredible logo.
This show is produced by the Archaeology Podcast Network, Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in Reno, Nevada at the Reno Collective.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.